Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, now to, I can't even say the, one of the most important stories going on right now, of course, is the chaos, really, the madness that has gripped Israel and their collective punishment of the Palestinians for the kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teens a few weeks back. And Max Blumenthal, you might have heard if you hear my other show, he was on last, I think, Friday, talking about, you know, giving us as much as he knew on the story. But boy, does he have a write-up for you here at the Electronic Intifada. Netanyahu government knew teens were dead as it whipped up racist frenzy. Welcome to the show, Max. How are you doing? Are you there? Oh, I hit the wrong button. Now how are you?
Now I'm even better.
Oh, good. I always get my Skype and my phone buttons crossed. Anyway, hey, this is a really great piece of work. We're going to run it as a news story rather than an opinion piece tomorrow at antiwar.com up in the top news. This is a great piece of journalism that you've put together here. And it's a long one and a very detailed one, so I'll just go ahead and give you the floor. Please take us through it. I'll interrupt if I think I have to.
Well, you know, before we get into the piece, you know, Gaza is being basically carpet bombed as we speak. In the last few hours, over 90 precision-guided missiles have fallen on the Gaza Strip. 32 people are dead, including all members of an entire family except the 10-year-old boy. The Gaza Strip is in flames, and Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip, has authorized rocket launches into Israel of homemade rockets and really outdated, antiquated, grad-style rockets, which are reaching pretty far. Just one recently hit just south of Tel Aviv, causing zero casualties. These rockets rarely cause any casualties that are not psychological. But you have the biggest escalation, military escalation, since November 2012, when over 200 people in the besieged Gaza Strip were killed by Israeli airstrikes. This is a direct result of Netanyahu and his inner circle and the military intelligence apparatus in Israel milking an extremely dangerous but very contained situation of three missing Israeli teens for all the political propaganda they could get out of it. And it's led directly to racist revenge killings, near pogroms across Israel against Palestinian communities, rioting in Palestinian neighborhoods, the brutal beating of a 15-year-old American boy who was on vacation in East Jerusalem, a Palestinian-American who was beaten nearly to death by Israeli police, who is still being held by Israeli police without charges, who the U.S. has not pressured Israel to release. And just to make a long story short, 2 weeks ago, three Israeli teenagers went missing while they were hitchhiking. They were kidnapped, apparently by a rogue Hamas cell. There's no indication there are any orders from Hamas to do this. No one's taken responsibility. And the accused kidnapper, one of them, is from a family with a long history of acting in contravention of Hamas orders. So you have a rogue cell that takes these kids. There is a phone call by one of the kidnapped teens to Israeli police. He called for help. He said, "We've been kidnapped." Gunshots were heard on the phone call. Then the kidnappers can be heard declaring, "We got three of them. We got three," then singing celebratory songs. The three kidnapped teens were dead. The parents of the teens were called in by the Shin Bet, Israel's General Security Service. They were played the phone call, and they said, "What are those gunshot sounds?" The Shin Bet and the Israeli police told them those are blanks, lying to the parents that their teens were dead so that they could use the parents for propaganda value. One of the mothers was even sent to the UN Human Rights Council in Switzerland to plead for international help. A gag order was placed on the Israeli media forbidding them and anyone who reported on it, they could go to jail. So forbidding them from reporting on the investigation, the details, even the gunshots and the phone call. In other words, to trick the Israeli public into believing that the teens were still alive. Within 24 hours, the Israeli police, Shin Bet, and army knew who the two suspected kidnappers were, where they lived, and were combing their homes. That, too, was kept from the Israeli public. Israeli forces rampaged throughout the West Bank, raiding over 15,000 Palestinian homes, arresting over 560 Palestinians, most of whom were remotely affiliated with Hamas. 200 are being held without charges. 6 people were killed. And the entire region, or Israel-Palestine, was plunged into political chaos. So about a week and a half go by, and the bodies are found. The bodies of the 3 Israeli teens lay in a shallow grave on the property of one of the suspected kidnappers, who the Israeli military intelligence apparatus and Netanyahu had known all along were the suspected kidnappers, were being investigated. They were not even found by Israeli police. They were found by a volunteer team, to show you that just how incredibly botched this investigation was and how the manipulation fed into the bungling practices of the police. So the bodies were found. Netanyahu releases an insane statement, completely inflammatory, calling for blood vengeance and invoking pogroms against Jews in turn-of-the-century Europe. Israeli society goes mad. Mobs march into the streets chanting death to Arabs. And a group of young men who met at one of these marches, which were staged all over the country as thousands upon thousands of young Jewish Israelis took to Facebook to call for revenge, to post pictures of themselves with their weapons and their military gear calling for revenge. A group of young men met at one of these marches and decided to look for Palestinian boys to kidnap and kill. They found one in the occupied neighborhood of Shufat in East Jerusalem, forced him to drink gasoline, burned him alive, dumped his body in the woods. Rioting broke out as the Israeli police put a gag order on that investigation and held that boy's body while attempting to implicate his own family in the crime. 6 young Jewish nationalist men have been arrested, and they are the killers. But by now, that's all forgotten. Israel has started bombing the Gaza Strip, claiming that Hamas was responsible. Hamas was responsible for the kidnapped teens. Therefore, all of Hamas will pay, in the words of Netanyahu, who called them in his official statement, human animals. Human animals, leading to this spree of bloodshed. Now, because the Gaza Strip is governed by Hamas, the Israeli Air Force has started bombarding it. Hamas has fired rockets, and the bombing of Gaza has intensified. And here we are in a situation of chaos that shows no sign of ebbing. All the result of political manipulation and incitement from the highest levels of the Israeli government.
Unreal. Unreal, except for how common it all seems.
And
anyway,
these are established facts on the record, Scott. Right. None of this.
Well, we're going back over
dispute.
To the more controversial ones here in just a second. Let me remind everybody, I'm talking with Max Blumenthal. Here he is at electronicintifada.net. And the article is Netanyahu government knew teens were dead as it whipped up racist frenzy. And again, I'm urging you guys to read this thing. It's, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 words or something. Very well reported piece of work here by Max Blumenthal. I do hope that you guys will find it, read it, pass it around on your social media and all of that kind of thing if you could. You'll want to once you're done reading it, I promise, before you're done. But now, so let me go back over a few of these facts just to make sure you have a chance to actually establish them here. When it comes to, and this is just in the order of my notes, not importance or anything here. When it comes to the known, your certainty that they knew the boys were dead. It wasn't just that you can prove that they had heard the 911 call or its equivalent, right? The call of the police recording with the gunshots in it. But it's the fact that they lied to the parents and said that somehow they knew that that those were blanks, and then, of course, denied any evidence of actual bullets or bullet wounds, say, for example, like blood in the car, that kind of thing. The fact that they lied, is there any other thing that's leading you to your certainty that they, I mean, that's pretty strong evidence, don't get me wrong, but do you have anything else on they had to have known the boys were dead by that point?
Well, the lying to the parents was shocking.
Yeah, I mean, that is incredible.
And the refusal to even prepare, emotionally prepare the Israeli public for the possibility that they might be dead was the most dangerous part, because they set the Israeli public up to believe that the boys would be released in some kind of prisoner exchange, as Gilad Shalit was. And then when they were given the news that they were actually dead, it was like a jolt to this very tribal, closely knit society. And it led to directly to the revenge spree. So I'm saying they didn't even make an effort to allow the Israeli public to consider the possibility that these teens might have been dead, when all of the evidence pointed to about a 99% certainty that they were dead, from the phone call to the lying to the parents to the simple fact that the Shin Bet, Israel's intelligence, the General Security Service, has the West Bank under lock and key. It knows what's happening in every corner of the West Bank. It has collaborators, Palestinian collaborators, completely honeycombed through every hen house, flop house, outhouse, and coffee house, and was able to zero in on any Hamas member it wanted to and arrest them in their bed. But it couldn't simply determine that these teens were nowhere to be found because they had been buried. So it really is mind-boggling that this was some kind of mistake. The Israeli government has also admitted that it knew who the suspects were within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. But when
and
it
you
did
say they
so,
found bullets and blood in the car. And when did they find the car? Right away?
The car was found right away. And this is reported. A burned, stolen car was found right away. And the Israeli police denied, told the parents that no DNA was found in the car, when in fact bullets and blood were found in the car. Mm-hmm. Right, if bullets and blood are found in the car, that means that they are probably dead or extremely wounded.
And then later you say they admitted that they knew all along the identity of their two prime suspects, or they admitted all along that they knew the identity of their two primes. Oh, it was because they raided their houses right away was how that leaked, right?
Well, I was able to determine the names of the suspects through Palestinian media, through Arabic language media, which was not subject to the gag order. The families had gone to Arabic language media and said, our houses are being raided, they're coming for our sons. The mother of one of the suspects, Marwan Kowasne, said, well, if he did it, I'm proud of him and I hope he gets away. So there was not even an attempt to deny that they were gone. Their names have been given to the Israelis by the Palestinian Authority, which coordinates its security with the Israeli army and is basically an arm of the Israeli occupation. It's basically the Bantustan Authority. So this information was basically whitewashed out of the Israeli media or prevented from reaching the Israeli public by the gag order. And, you know, in a normal criminal investigation in this country, if a suspect is wanted for a high crime, their posters appear everywhere, in every post office. They'll be on TV even. And the police will give press conferences announcing their names and asking the public to help find them. In Israel, what happened in an incredibly abnormal society was the opposite. Their names were concealed from the Israeli public so that the public could believe that they could be anywhere in the West Bank among any Hamas cell to justify the military escalation. And Hamas was blamed, the entire organization. Although the organization had no knowledge of the kidnapping, took no responsibility for it, and really has a very tenuous relationship with the two men who are accused.
And yeah, now let me get back to that too. That's a very important point. You say it's this rogue faction, but it's not just that, oh yeah, three different people use the term rogue faction. You actually know a thing or two about this breakoff group, basically, of Hamas. You say they have a history of screwing things up for Hamas.
Yes, Shlomi Eldar, who is an Israeli reporter, a veteran Israeli correspondent, who's covered Hamas and the Palestinian Authority for about 20, 30 years, wrote a piece for Al Monitor about the history of the Kawasme clan and their role in attacks that were carried out during ceasefires between Hamas and Israel during the Second Intifada, and how Hamas leadership privately condemned the attacks in phone calls to the Israeli government and said, "We had nothing to do with these suicide attacks. We were trying to honor the ceasefire." The Israelis would then use the opportunity to assassinate major Hamas leaders, which, you know, suggests that,
raises questions, doesn't it? Yeah.
Raises serious questions. I mean, let's just say that in the 1970s, there was a figure named Abu Nidal, who was probably the world's most prominent Palestinian terrorist. And in his hijackings and killings, besides the hijackings and killings that he was known for, he mostly killed Palestinians who were from rival factions. He mostly carried out attacks during ceasefires, and he was widely suspected of being a Mossad agent. So, and it's pretty well established that he was. So there is precedent for that. I'm not saying these men were agents of the Shin Bet or Mossad. It's just that this attack, this kidnapping occurred at an extremely suspicious time, right after Fatah and Hamas signed a unity deal, which both factions were celebrating and which the U.S. recognized. So the U.S. de facto recognized the legitimacy of Hamas, and Netanyahu went crazy. He had a conniption fit and wanted to find a way of fracturing the unity deal. So let's just say this was a moment of opportunity for Netanyahu, and he wasn't going to let it go to waste.
Yeah. All right, and now, in the scheme of things, compared to what you just said about, you know, the global politics and all this, this is back to the microscope, but it's just so outrageous, this spin that the boy that was lynched and did you say, made to drink gasoline before being set alight, that they blamed his own parents for his murder?
The Israeli police leaked information through the Israeli media that Mohammed Abu Khader, who was killed in a revenge crime by Jewish terrorists, was gay and was killed by his family in an honor crime. Absolutely zero evidence, which is consistent with the Israeli government's deployment of the tactic of pinkwashing, where they present themselves as this haven for LGBT rights, for gay rights in the Middle East, and they paint their enemies as haters of gays in order to appeal to liberals who might otherwise be disgusted by the Israeli occupation and human rights abuses. And in this case, they attempted to deploy that tactic in order to deflect blame from their own society for the killing of this young boy. And these kind of killings, these lynchings, which recall the lynching of Emmett Till in this country, are not uncommon. This is just one of the first times we've seen it reported in our mainstream media. In my book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, I detail numerous lynchings which were carried out almost in the same place and by the same kind of characters, products of the Israeli education system and its culture of militarization. Lynchings of young Palestinian men in Jerusalem, and this is, you know, this is a fact of life in Israel today. It's a fact of the status quo. And you say this is, you know, a microscope. We're looking at it through a microscope. We are looking at it through a microscope. But where we're standing is in the United States. While we look in that microscope, we're standing in the benefactor of this occupation, the benefactor of apartheid. And it's the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel, which is responsible for all the hideous bacteria and toxins that we're viewing under that microscope right now.
Yep. Well, and see, that's the thing, man, is, you know, I'm not one for negotiating with terrorists, and so the fact that Osama bin Laden and his hijacker pilots constantly cited Israel as part of their motivation for attacking the United States and just getting, you know, round two of the terror war started back 13 years ago now. It would just be an interesting piece of trivia if what they hated about Israel was nice little Israel minding its own business, and these guys are just basically a bunch of Arab Nazis who can't leave Israel alone because of just how much they hate Jews for no reason or some kind of thing, well then screw them, I guess we have to fight them. Except, that's not what's going on here. They've cited the crimes of Israel, what any honest, decent, objective person can describe as the immoral behavior of the Israeli government and what it does to the people in the occupation. At the time of 9/11, they included the occupation of Lebanon, of course, but same difference, too. And so it's what Israel is doing wrong that America is backing that got us attacked on September 11th. So, you know, sorry if that's just a utilitarian argument for you or something, but that was a pretty damn big deal when it happened. And I bet most Americans wouldn't think it was worth it if they had anything like the facts to compare, you know, what's going on here to the consequences and see what they think the policy should be then.
I'm really glad you raised that point. I was about to raise it myself. In his book, The Looming Tower, Lawrence Wright writes about Al-Libi, who is one of bin Laden's commanders, who was radicalized by the Israeli attack during Operation Grapes of Wrath in southern Lebanon on Qana, which left hundreds of women and children dead in a UN shelter with precision-guided weapons authorized by then-Prime Minister Shimon Peres, who's portrayed around the world as this man of peace. That was the moment that turned Al-Libi into an Al-Qaeda, a radicalized Al-Qaeda recruit, and many more are being created as we speak. We see the seeds of hatred be sowed right before our eyes. We also have to remember that the first Intifada in 1987 began with a very small incident that occurred under a microscope. It was an Israeli jeep, a military patrol running over a Palestinian worker in Gaza and leaving the scene. The jeep was surrounded by Palestinians who stoned it and chased the soldiers out, and that led to the first major Palestinian uprising. The second Intifada was began with Ariel Sharon ascending the Temple Mount in a staged incident to provoke Palestinians to violence. It led after 1.3 million Israeli bullets were fired at mostly unarmed Palestinian protesters and stone throwers. It led to the wave of suicide bombing inside Israel. So these minor incidents have a way of snowballing, and there's no reason to believe that we won't be talking about a greater wave of catastrophic violence, whether it's in Israel, Palestine, or somewhere else in the next month or 6 months or year. And that's why it's important to keep an eye on this and to scrutinize our own media for whitewashing it and omitting the facts and context of these incidents.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think one of the most important things that you hit on here tonight was the language of the Prime Minister of Israel denouncing his enemies, their enemies, supposedly, as animals. That ought to be the top headline of the New York Times, that this is what, I mean, imagine if Barack Obama was calling, you know, even the Taliban or anyone, animals, they're animals. American presidents don't talk like that, not in public anymore or whatever anyway, not since Nixon, I don't know. There's some kind of thing here where, well, since World War II, right, where that kind of dehumanization of the enemy is a little bit, at least a little bit suspicious, and is the kind of thing that we should be very wary of, because we know what happens when people really start believing that this group of people is actually some kind of vermin rather than some kind of person.
Yeah, we've seen it throughout history. And, you know, Jewish history paints a pretty clear picture of how incitement can lead to mob violence, pogroms, and even genocide. And the genocide of Jews in Europe began with that kind of dehumanization and incitement and didn't reach a genocidal phase until the Wannsee Conference. Before then, before the final solution was devised, it was basically the Nazis kind of trying to decide what to do with this population that they had condemned as animals. We're not in a genocidal phase in Israel-Palestine, but we're witnessing troubling incitement that's causing a lot of even liberal Zionists who, you know, people who had ignored or criticized my book on the fascist trends in Israel, to draw these comparisons between Israeli society today and German society in the 1930s. These kind of comparisons are becoming increasingly common.
By the way, you mentioned that last week on the show, and I meant to ask you the follow-up. I'm glad you mentioned it again about, can you recommend some articles to read about that? Who it was that had criticized you, who then now is using that same kind of language? I'm interested in that.
Well, I would just point to Hemi Shalev, who is the U.S. correspondent for Haaretz, which is the main newspaper of the liberal enlightened public of Israel, who has written, just drawn a direct line between 1930s Germany and current day Israel in an opinion piece he wrote last week. And while Shalev never criticized me, he typically interviews authors of books about Israel. He compared Peter Beinart to Mick Jagger, and he basically ignored my book. The only mention of my book in Haaretz was through extremely negative reviews. And, you know, he's been praised by people who either ignored my work or participated in the kind of criticism and smear campaigns of it. And I find that really ironic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just terrible to be vindicated in this way.
Right.
And I always wind up saying, unfortunately, I was right. So it's another case of, you know, being unfortunately right.
Sure. And, you know, this isn't that whole thing, argument ad Hitlerum or whatever, where whatever law that you're not supposed to bring up the Nazis or whatever. Like, no, we really are talking about pogroms and race hatred and that kind of, you know, like you said, we're not at the WANSI conference period yet here, but we do seem to be, you know, we got demagogues like Netanyahu in charge of the place. You know, they're not the backbenchers.
He's considered a centrist. I mean, in his own coalition. One of the rising stars, Ayelet Shaked, from the Jewish Home Party, which controls major ministerial positions in his cabinet, issued a call for Palestinian genocide on Facebook, and it got thousands of likes from Israelis. So the calls for genocide are right there. They're in the streets of Israel, and they're in Netanyahu's cabinet. How much more evidence do you need to be troubled and shocked and to be, you know, jolted out of your stupor where you consider this to be a situation that's too complex to take any position on? I mean, it's all right there. It's all unfolding right before our eyes.
Oh, Max, I'm sorry. Are you still there? I'm sitting there talking with the mic off the whole time. Anyway, that was the great Max Blumenthal, everybody. I completely blew the ending. I was trying to ask him to end with what is going on in the Gaza Strip right now. But as he said, airstrikes, 90-something airstrikes. Last I saw, it was at least in the double digits killed. I'm not exactly sure. And they'd call up the reserves. Was it 40,000? Let me look at antiwar.com, y'all, one time. 40,000 troops mobilized for possible, at least threatened, ground invasion of Gaza based on this whipped up campaign. So there's your bad news.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org.